go suck a fat one.
I have an addiction to smut. I'm right-handed, but my ball sack is left-sided. Get the B-Man a double cheeseburger. Take the tip and shut up. Hello, Internet, and welcome to episode 106 of Verbal Graffiti with your host, Brian Glass, a.k.a. the B-Man, the People's Degenerate. Plug in your Hitachi wand and let's have ourselves a freaky episode. That's where we're going. This episode of Verbal Graffiti, 106, as always, the B-Man being redundant. Have any of you ever actually seen a Hitachi wand in use other than on the internet or someone else on the other side of the screen using it? Because I have not. There was one time when a babe broke up with me. We weren't really together. We were occasionally hooking up, fucking, throughout the course of a few years. When I say the course of a few years, I mean once or twice per year. She put the kibosh on the B-Man, said, I want no more part of you. And then I bought her a Hitachi wand because she had never masturbated, and she threw it out. So that was a waste of nearly $100. If none of you know what the Hitachi wand is, and I do like saying that word, Hitachi wand, I will put a photo of it right here. It kind of looks like the Hitachi wand, for those who are unfamiliar with it, it does resemble a Little League baseball bat with a bit of a nub at the end. If you did not know what it was, you could mistake it for a regular back massage, leg massage thing, because I think you could actually, that's actually what it was meant for. But some of you freaky fucks with those cooters between your legs figured, oh, you just put it on that. Similar to how some babes put peanut butter and have their dogs lick it off. All right. Where the hell are we going with episode 106? I don't know. I don't know. Hitachi, what? Okay, B-Man, enough with the Hitachi wand. You've never seen one. You've never used one on anybody. So stop talking about something you know nothing about. Okay. Let me talk about something else I know nothing about. I was doing stand-up last night. That's how I start many of these sentences on Verbal Graffiti. I was doing stand-up, and there was a babe who went up before me, a few comics before me, and she was talking. She might have been the freakiest of all freaks. Of all the freaks in the world, this babe may be the freakiest. She was dressed conservatively, which most of the freaks are. I noticed that any babe who wears a turtleneck usually ends up being the freakiest of all the freaks. I don't know if they're trying to throw the scent off, but that's what they do, those freaks of freaks. But she was talking on stage. And what do they call those? Those clothing clips, clothes pins. Again, I'll put a photo here. I haven't seen one of these since my mom used to use them as a child with our clothing. Once again, if you don't know, I'm the youngest of five. So my mom, when we were younger, would do a lot of laundry. Yes, are we doing gender stereotypes here? Yes, we are, Verbal Graffiti, because the B-Man, I am a misogynist. But again, that is for another segment. But anyway, those clothespins, those ones that are made, they're made out of that light, thin, light brown wood with the little metal in between, and you use those clips to hang clothing to dry on the line outside in the backyard if you're one of those old school dryers and you want to save the environment. Anyway, so that's the thing the babe on stage was talking about. She was talking or pontificating or bragging, I should say, about, all right, this is her kink. She likes to put these clothing clips on her man's penis, on his wiener, and she was talking about how she broke her own personal record. The night before, she had put 127 of these clothing clips on her man's penis, and right away, when I heard that, I thought, there's no way this could be real, and which is often the case with comics. They'll embellish. That's kind of what we do as comics. We embellish for the sake of the laugh. That tends to be okay. Nobody, Nobody gets upset when a comic embellishes as long as you get a laugh. But I was laughing. I wasn't really laughing. It was one of those statements that piqued my interest. Because right away, when she had said that, I was thinking, clothing clips, 127. My immediate thought was, well, how big, how girthy is your man's wiener to be able to have enough surface on the penis to clip 127 of those clothes clips on his wiener? And then my second thought was, well, doesn't that hurt your man's wiener? You can have 127. Those are basically mouse traps on your wiener. Doesn't that bleed, cause some swelling or blistering? A lot of questions to be man had. And I'm not one to hold back. I'm not one for small talk. So later that night, last night, we were at the bar, and I went up to her and go, hey, that thing you did with your man, 127 closed clips, is that true? Or were you bullshitting us up there for the sake of a laugh? And she's like, oh, no, it's true. I really did my personal record, 127 closed clips on my man's wiener last night. And she goes, do you want to see a video of it? And I thought, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. The B-man would like to see a photo of this. And it kind of hit me in that moment that I am immune from seeing penis. I've seen so much penis because of all the smut I watch over the years that seeing a dick pic or a video of a penis, it does nothing for me. It doesn't ick me out. Again, I'm a heterosexual, usually when I watch smut, I like to see insertion. That's usually when I get my nut after my hours of edging and gooning. I like to see actual insertion. That's the only thing. That's what I like to save my bust for. Anyway, so she showed us a photo. It was actually, the lady I said was a heavyset black lady. The guy with the clothes clips on him was a skinny white guy. So the two of them immediately together, I mean, that's a cartoon. A skinny white guy, heavyset black lady, you know, the changes in shapes and sizes right next to each other, that's a cartoon. And then seeing the clothes clips on him, this lady was not bullshitting. This was no lie. She showed me a few-minute video of her on her knees taking the clothes clips and putting it, like, around his... most of them were on his balls, more so than his shaft. It was... And it was not a huge penis. It was a pedestrian. It was a boyfriend penis. There was nothing... You know, when you hear that a man has 127 closed clips on his wiener, you just imagine you're going to have a black mamba type wiener. But this was just a normal white man, I'm guessing 6-7 inches. And a video of her literally putting all these clips on his wiener. And then when I saw the video and realized, oh, this lady, this might be the kinkiest of all kinks, I asked her, well, do you have intercourse before the clothes clips or after putting the clothes clips on the guys? Because again, as I previously said, I just think if you put clothes clips on my wiener, there are going to be some welts, there's going to be some discomfort. Having sex afterwards might not be feasible. And my suspicions were confirmed. She told me, this comedian last night, no, we have intercourse, insertion, and then the clothes clips I put on afterwards, after, the lovemaking is consummated. So, and that is, that's why I like to go out. You meet some weirdos when you do stand-up comedy. But my big takeaway from this was, I will never see this lady. I do not want to be one-on-one with this lady with nobody else there, because I like Mr. Perfect, and I don't want any welts or any mice or mousetrap marks on my shaft. All right, what I'm getting at here is, this is the problem with these kinky, sex, exotic clubs that people go to in New York and LA, and this comic told me last night there is one in Connecticut, somewhere in Windsor, is you're just a normal John like myself. You go there like, hey man, I want to get off rub and tug style, just, you know, wank, insertion, normal, pee. Like, what we gotta have with these sex clubs is ratings, similar to movies. You gotta have your PG version, which, hey, we're just gonna have everything's consensual, but it's just normal sex, oral, and then all the way up to NC-17 XXX, where you're putting foreign objects, you're clamping them to each other's genitals, and because the problem is, you go to one of these clubs, and I've never been, so this is all, I'm conjuring this all up in my head, what may go down at those clubs, but you go to those clubs wanting sex, and you end up in a Guantanamo Bay type situation where being waterboarded, you're hanging on for your last breath of life because to fulfill someone else's kink, and you're upside down, nearly drowning. And I just wanted to get a nut. I just wanted an orgasm. And now I'm in some contraption with a mask on, with a little straw that I breathe through. And I got some lady like, stepping on my ball sack. And there's a room full of people chanting at me. And you're like, dude, I just wanted to have missionary sex. But that's not an option at this club, because only people who go to these sex clubs are the freakiest or the freaks. They are the Guantanamo Bay of the freaks. So we need a rating system, movie-wise, similar to at all these freaky sex clubs, which I've never been to one, because I don't know if you know anything about those sex clubs, but the research I've done, single men are not... they're not, how do you say, they are not the clientele that's wanted at those venues. Those venues, like lesbians, are guys who bring lots of women with them. Single guys coming by their lonesome tend not to get in those clubs. And if they do, they tend to, from what I've been told, stand in the corner. All right, so, but hey, we don't kink shame here, and I don't know if 127 closed clips is a Guinness Book of World Records. Maybe I'll have to do some research. And if it is, I'll let this comedian know. And maybe, you know, she'll become famous in that page of the Guinness Book of World Records. A lot of weirdos out there. A lot of weirdos out there in this world. All right, moving along. Moving along to something I found on Reddit. Comes from, as I spit my, I notice I spit a lot. All right, I'm going to have to clip that one. All right, comes from the subreddit Professors Hard Facts. I went down the internet rabbit hole today and found some of my midterm questions and answers were uploaded to Stuvia. From the username, I know exactly who the student is, but that's besides the point. This is her side hustle. She has course packets, answer keys, exams, priced from $13.99 to $65.99. According to her seller's profile, using her join date and seller stats, based on average selling median price, she made more money than I did this past semester. Well, Professor, a doctor, you just outed yourself as a lazy fuck teacher. And that's what you did, right? Because if you, let me get my thoughts together, all right? I'm still thinking about the 127 close clips. All right, focus, B-man. Focus on this professor who is a lazy fuck. See, what you did here is you outed yourself because you obviously do not change your midterm and the answer key every semester. Because if you did, like a teacher who cares about his profession and his students, you wouldn't have former students who would be able to sell the exams and the answers. Because that's how that proves that you're lazy. Because you give the same exact exam every semester. Students obviously talk. So that's why this student is able to make money off of you because of your laziness. You are the stereotypical teacher who we all know, right? We have the professor. We all seen movies. At midterm, you know, you pull out your desk, you pull out the exam, and you use the same one every single semester. So thank you for outing yourself. And the second thing about this is you're not upset with this student. Who you're upset? You're using this student making money off of you to complain about what all teachers and professors love to complain about most, and that's how you don't make any money. That's what you're complaining to the referee of life. That you're raising your hand, like, hey, this lady, my former student, she's making more money than me. That's what upsets you more so than her selling the exam answers. Because that's what I'd say 50% of people who get into education as a profession do so they can complain about how much money they make. And while you're going to church to get a free loaf of bread because you can't afford groceries because you're a professor, it's funny because, you know, teachers love to bitch and moan about how they don't make as much money as all their peers do. But almost every teacher I know owns an SUV and has a mortgage. So how do you put those two together? How can you bitch about how making no money, but then you live in a 3-bedroom house, have an SUV or a pickup truck, and you're able to go on a vacation every summer, and you can go to Disney World every April vacation? You can't complain about how much money you make when you drive an SUV. All right, enough with the money. Sometimes definitions, your definition of something and the B-man's definition of something can be completely polar opposite. Because when you, as a professor, say, hey, I did a deep dive on the internet, immediately the B-man, my thought goes to Frazzle Drip and the Red Shoe Club. If you know, you know. If you don't, just Google those words. Actually, those... No, we're going all over the place this episode. There are certain terms you put in Google and nothing comes up. That's how you know it's a real internet deep dive. When you have to go to other search engines to find out information on certain topics or conspiracy theories. And again, Frazzle Drip, a Red Shoe Club. Those are two. You're not going to find much information on Google. So go to Yandex or what's... Oh, I don't know, all those other search engines, go to those. But back to you being the professor. Apparently, this is your deep dive. Your subject matter, it doesn't matter. Like you're teaching a meaningless subject. Because if your student is able to sell the midterm and final exams for $30, it's clearly not a subject that's difficult to learn. It's a subject matter that anybody could just put in a ChatGPT or Gemini and get all the answers. Because if it was a very, very difficult science, microbiology or some science, neuroscience, some word I can't even pronounce, then you wouldn't have former students being able to sell the answer keys, which tells me you're probably teaching some bullshit human science, like anthropology 101 or family studies or political science. That's what I majored in. That's the only reason why I was able to graduate college is because I had a bullshit fake major, political science. So I mean, that's what that tells me about you. If you're really you should be thankful that you have a former student who is using her brain and ingenuity to make money off of you. Because you would be, if this makes you upset, this former student selling the midterm answers to the students you have now, just Imagine if you went on the internet and looked at OnlyFans, because that might make you suicidal, seeing how many former students of yours, female former students, babes former students of yours, who are able to afford a beachfront property because for $10.99 a month, they show the Johns how many ice cubes they could fit inside their cooter, their slit, their vagina, their fur burger. You'd be shocked at how much money your former students are making on that site. So be thankful that you have a former student who's actually using her brain and not her TNA to make a profit. This is why part of the reason why I left the teaching profession, the main reason was because nobody wanted me. Anyone who was in a position to hire a teacher or refused to hire me. And there was also a little percentage of me wanted to get out of teaching because I did realize that almost all the students I had would end up making more money than I do as a teacher. And there's some bitterness, spitefulness that I have with that fact that would always prevent me from finding true happiness. So I had to get out of that genre of work. So as a professor who makes dog shit salary, and you should be thankful for the amount of money you make, because it's all because of federal grants, overpriced tuition, and this bullshit grants that, I don't know, your university gets. But yeah, you're making money. All your students, I mean, that's, as a professor, isn't that kind of what you expect? That you're going to have former students that make more than you do as a professor, teacher, or whatever bullshit community college you're working at. So that's part of the game. Like, you got to expect that there are going to be former students who are going to make more money than you. And as a professor, stop being such a lazy fuck. I'm not even saying change the exams that you're given each semester. I'm merely just saying, hey, just tweak the A, B, C, D multiple choice, like rearrange the letters so that it's not the exact same. Yeah, I'm not saying you have to not be lazy. You just have to be a little bit creative, moving around with your laziness so that you can't, you cannot, in this day and age, you cannot, as a teacher, be giving this same exact exam every semester, but clearly you are. So just for me to you, the professor, you are a terrible teacher. You are not preparing today's youth to thrive in this economy. So I'm glad that this former student is making a profit off of your teaching. Let's go look at some photos. Remember to share an episode or a segment of Verbal Graffiti with your favorite playmate of the year. I guess since it's 2025, maybe you should share Verbal Graffiti with your favorite Instagram model. Because who collects Playboys anymore? The B-Man, I do not collect Playboys, but I do collect Playboy cover baseball cards. This is a trading card from the June 1960 cover of Playboy. I have, I don't know, 10 or 20 of these. They're fun. You know, I the thing I enjoy about these is not the smuttiness. If you know anything about the history of the Playboy magazine, you'll know that the earlier decades of Playboy, the 1950s, 60s, even into some of the 70s, a lot of the covers weren't photos and pictures of the actual model that was in the Playboy magazine, but it was actually more cartoonish. A lot of the covers had an actual Playboy bunny. So I've always been drawn to the artistic covers of Playboy more so than the smutty covers of modern Playboys that are, you know, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And this one has a playmate driving a fancy car, and the inside article is about Frank Sinatra's meeting at the summit. Also, a fun thing about Playboy magazines is they do chronologically show the history of pop culture in America, hence Frank Sinatra. You'll notice if you look at a lot of the covers of Playboy, you'll see a lot of pop stars that are in musicians and actors and athletes on the cover. The articles, they'll have like the model and then what's inside, and what's inside they'll list, you know, Frank Sinatra. So you know what I do with these? You know, B-Man, what do you do with all these Playboy cards of yours? What I do is I place them around my work laptop because I work from home. So I'm alone in my bedroom with my laptop, and having all these playmates around me, seeing actual faces, it does put me in a more spirited mood. I wonder what my employer would think of that if they actually knew about this. Moving along, I spend most of my evenings after stand-up doom scrolling through X because no babes want to sleep with me. And I've noticed there are a lot of protesting going on now in the U.S. over illegal immigration. Illegal immigrations and how many people and who should be deported, that's all above my pay grade, which is $20 per hour. But I noticed, we're in California, there was one of these protests where a lot of the protesters were holding up the Mexican flag, a lovely flag. I enjoy the contents of that flag. It's very colorful. But it did strike me that the flag is very primitive. And it is surprising to the B-Man that humans have not moved past using a flag as a thing to identify who they are or who their group of people are. Like, we've been using flags to identify our nations or our tribe for thousands of years. Flags are very, I mean, they were using flags in the Middle Ages. You think with all the technology that we will move past a rectangle piece of fabric with some lines and stars and symbols on it, that we'd have some type of holograph. I don't want to say NFT, but there'd be some type of drone or we'd carry something other than just a pole with a little flag in the wind. Come on, humanity, let's move past just a stupid little piece of fabric that's just a glorified quilt, right? Right? So when I saw all those Mexicans holding up their flags, and this is humans in general. I just saw Mexican flags. That's why I'm pointing out the Mexicans. It's like, hey, why is that? Why do we need a flag to identify our land and this group of people? There's something very tribal about that. And we, as humanity grows and as we evolve, we should evolve past using flags. All right, moving into something more lighthearted. This one comes from the subreddit. Guy Cry, Mad-Betrayed. I, 55, male, two nights in a row have been passed out drunk. Good for you. I know it's stress-related. Wife, 49, female, nice. I received a call from her mother. Apparently, one of our kids is telling the in-laws stuff, not knowing the full story. They want my wife to leave me. Apparently, now I'm to blame for my wife's drinking problems. I take blame for my mistakes, so I'm at a point where I don't care what happens. Well, first of all, I want to thank my parents for not being drunks. And now this is, all right, I'm going to have to do the Rubik's Cube for this one to try to defend your actions. First of all, I love the fact there's something that warms my black heart that you readily admit that you've been blackout drunk the past two nights, the past 48 hours due to your stress, and you have the audacity to point out your wife's drinking problems. I tip of my penis to you for that temerity to do that. Now, you should be furious with your kids for trying to rat you out. You should have raised better kids than this. No kids should be ratting out anybody, especially their own parents. That was rule number one in my household when we grew up, was you were not allowed to rat out anybody. Your sister hits you. Your brother puts you in a noogie. You get pinned up against a wall. Someone hits you with a baseball bat. You break a window. And your parents ask you, who broke the window, Brian? And then they'd be upset with me in the moment, but afterwards, my dad would come up to me and go, hey, I'm happy you didn't rat out your brother, Kevin. So they're like, that's where you're a terrible parent. It's not being blacked out for 48 hours. It's not teaching your kids the morals when they were at an age where you could have instilled those morals into them. Now, I am apt to believe you and your argument that your wife is a drunk more so than you, because it takes an alcoholic to know an alcoholic. And if you're drinking two nights in a row, as you refer to it as a bender, so two nights in a row bender, like, you're an alcoholic. So you know an alcoholic when you see one, and clearly your wife is an alcoholic if you're calling her one. So, I don't think the grandparents are in a position where they should be taking the kids away from you, because I'm apt to believe you when you said that your wife is more of a drunk than you are, and her liver is way more pickled than your liver. So your kids are probably better off and safer with you than they are your whore of a wife. And all right, let me do a little pro bono work too. And this comes from the B-man. I'll do pro bono. Do know that I took one law class in college. I got a C in it. So I do feel like I am qualified to be your unpaid lawyer. How much damage can you really do to your children if you're blackout drunk? Now, if you're blackout drunk, that means you're unconscious, you can't raise your hand. So how can you really hurt your children if you're not able to consciously lift your arm? There's no physical harm that you can do to your children. So I'll make the argument as your lawyer that being blackout drunk, passed out drunk, is the safest state of mind you can be in for your lovely two children. All right. I know that's a stretch. It's a stretch. But again, I'm working pro bono. If you paid me, maybe I'd come up with a better argument. And this is, I blame your grandparents too, because I'm looking at your age. You're 55. Your whore of a wife is 49. Nice. That's a 6-year age gap. We like age gap relationships here at Verbal Graffiti. So you snagged one 6 years younger than yourself, probably able to do so because he's a drunk whore. Anyways, all right, back to your story, back to your situation. So I'm guesstimating that your children are past puberty, are currently in puberty at this moment. So like, if your grandparents, or sorry, their grandparents, your wife's parents, if they were really concerned about the grandkids, where the fuck had they been the last decade? It's clearly you and your wife did not start drinking in your mid-40s, mid-50s. You've been drinking since those kids were born. And now, the grandparents, when the kids are, what, early teenagers, now they want to call DCF on you and have the kids taken from you? I'm calling foul there. Those are terrible grandparents, much more terrible grandparents, then you are a drunk father. Yeah, yeah, you're a deadbeat father. Yeah, you're drunk, and maybe you're not there for all the events, but neither is that whore of a wife of yours. You know, she's more of a drunk than you are. There's a reason why she's not able to go to all the dance recitals. It's because she had her third Long Island iced tea at the local bar happy hour, and that's why she missed the recital once again, because she can't drive. And really, right, who the fuck are these grandparents to be pointing out you and saying, oh, you're a drunk, those kids are, it's unsafe to be with you. It's like, grandparents, look in the mirror. Your daughter is a lush. That you're calling me a drunk? Look at your daughter. Look how you raised her. Maybe it's her fault, not mine. It's actually your fault, the grandparents, for teaching your daughter to be a lush and a whore of a wife. So it's all them. They are way out of pocket, wanting to take your children away from you. What I would do as the father, I would tell the grandparents face-to-face. I would not do this over the phone or via text. I'd meet them on their doorstep of their house that you probably helped pay for. And I go, listen, you try to take my kids away from me again, and I'm moving to a different state with the kids. Because this is not, I'm not going to be quiet about this incident. Like, I cannot be at Thanksgiving dinner with the grandparents, knowing that the grandparents and my wife, their daughter, wants to excommunicate me from the family. No. The B-man and you should stand up and go, no, this is not happening, all right? Your daughter, my wife, she's as much of a drunk, if not more than me. And a family that drinks together stays together. Fuck those families that wake up early on Saturday and go for a hike or a bike ride. The families that stay together are the families that spend their Saturdays spiking their White Claws with tequila and drinking together until they find each other attractive once again. And fuck while the kids are out doing whatever the fuck it is they're doing on Saturday, probably playing games on their phone and all that bullshit. But that's it. I mean, there's a reason why you're 55 and your whore, slut, wife, lush of a wife, 49, have stayed together so long. It's because the two of you drink together. All right? If the two didn't drink together, you probably would have divorced years ago and you never would have been able to see the kids. And as for the kids, what about the kids? What about their life? Well, the one thing I know about, or I've heard about, kids who hate their father end up being the titans of Silicon Valley and or being very, very successful professionally. So you're being the best dad you can be. You're a absentee father who is a drunk. You pass out. Your kids probably hate you, but they're going to use that anger they have towards you to form their own way in life and become successful in Silicon Valley, in Wall Street. They're going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars because of your shitty parenting. So they get both success financially, career-wise, and also they'll have stories they can tell for a lifetime about how daddy passed out, hit his head on the table, and bled into our carpet twice this week. So I think you're doing a great job parenting. You're doing a great job as in your marriage life because the both of you drink together. Your wife, she's a whore. She's a lush. She is the one who should have her parenting skills questioned by the grandparents. And the grandparents, they need to go fuck themselves, because where have they been the last decade? Oh, I'm sorry. Now you're paying attention and you care about the grandkids? Nah. Your daughter's a whore. Your daughter's a lush. You're the worst parent out of the four of us. So to you, keep drinking. Keep getting blackout drunk. Your kids will be all right. All right, let's continue reading A Salesman's Wife by John Lawrence. We are really moving along in this book. We are about midway through page 81. We will read two pages together aloud, as I stumble over a bunch of words. Carlsberg lewdly savored the tingling sensations made by her teeth as they lightly grazed against the sensitive underside of his swollen tool. The lust rose in him like a column of fire. Gazing down at the terrified girl in her provocative costume gave him a tremendous sense of dominance and power. He laughed inwardly at the success of his therapy, for he had found a way to satisfy his deranged taste perfectly under legitimate guise. He exulted as he recalled the many other terrified young women who had come to him and submitted to his lewd activities willingly, happily. He was the master. They were his slaves, offering their creamy cunts to him day after day. "Suck my cock, you peasant bitch," he shouted in obscene triumph. With brutal force, he shoved a mammoth tool into her mouth, fucking furiously. Pamela had nearly collapsed as he did so, but called upon whatever reserve of strength she had to desperately continue her degrading act. Then, involuntarily, from somewhere deep in the darkest corner of her mind, a new feeling began to overtake her. A wave of savage lust to consciousness, aided by that drug, her shame and humiliation began to fade into nothingness. Suddenly, she was a peasant maiden sucking her arrogant captor's cock. She was living in a long time ago. Thrills of pleasure ran through her entire body, and she began to suck on Carlsberg's penis with eagerness. It was hard to believe, but she was actually beginning to enjoy it. She enjoyed sucking his wet, thick cock. She was his to command. All decency and morality were flung aside in that moment of ecstasy. She felt the sexy and wildly provocative, overwhelmed with her new identity. She slavered over his hot tool with wet, smacking lips. What had been loathsome to her only moments ago now began to take hold with her demonic force. Her body was palpitating wildly, and her heart beat like a savage jungle drum. She was no longer Pamela Burns, a meek, demure housewife. She was the willing slave of her captor. It was wonderful. She moaned as she licked and sucked furiously. Carlsberg smugly noted the change in her attitude, and he lustily shoved his hips back and forth, faster and faster, his body trembling with lewd passion. Pamela sucked greedily on his pulsing tool, then slid her mouth down over his hugely throbbing balls, while her hands continued to massage his cock. The hairy, round sacks filled her mouth with hot, pulsing flesh, and her lips worked hungrily over every inch of them. She was so lost in the burning pleasure of it now that she couldn't get enough. This was extraordinary, more thrilling than anything she had ever imagined. With a deep groan, she abandoned herself totally to the obscene act. Go suck a fat one.